Let's come right back to Van Vogt as an exemplary figure in the science fiction century of prophetic visioning. This is how Voyage of the Space Beagle begins. On and on, Gurel prowled. The black, moonless, almost starless night yielded reluctantly before a grim, reddish dawn that crept up from his left. It was a vague light that gave no sense of approaching warmth. It slowly revealed a nightmare landscape. Jagged black rock and black, lifeless plain took form around him. A pale red sun peered above the grotesque horizon. Fingers of light probed among the shadows, and still there was no sign of the family of id creatures that he had been trailing now for nearly 100 days. Predator. This is a page from a poetry volume that I did in 1983 called Los Angeles Matrix Sutra. And I took 16 planetary class people, friends, in Los Angeles at that particular time to do a pre-1984 matrix vision of what was happening in terms of Los Angeles as a prismatic world city. A.E. Van Vogt brought back the vision of the space beagle from our future. 1,000 men hurled from arm to arm of our galaxy and then further out. A new origin of species foreshadows the hero with his second 1,000 faces ready to express the adventures, astounding story indeed, of the unknown, plunged abyss, pure space, and brought forth the vision of Null A, worlds and players and more of doubling mind and widening stage and building pace, all to discover the final face still man. And then man's final face is there in his languages, and their style is form for him. So 200 are spoken here. Thus Van produced a 200 course. Kindly, kingly gentlemen, clear light writing high above Beechwood Canyon, ancient Chinese lounge enthroned, and stars above, stars below, here in Hollywood, carving literary dragons. The classic Chinese book on writing from about 2,000 years ago is The Art of Carving Literary Dragons by Liu Qi. The 200 was a reference to a language program that Van put together. He took a survey of Los Angeles and found that there were 200 languages spoken within the greater Los Angeles area. So his problem to himself, he was this kind of a visionary, is there any way to really jumpstart the quick learning of language so that someone could learn all 200 languages? So he pioneered, using his great hypnotic and general semantics talents and his science fiction visioning, and he came up with a way in which to learn languages without studying languages, that it was to make a penetration to the original intelligence of the infant, of the child who learns English or learns Spanish, learns their home language without having to study grammar or vocabularies. How can you do this? And he came up with a program. He had a white Malamute named Stava that he used to take long walks in the Hollywood Hills. And he realized that this was the perfect boy's medium, walking your dog in the hills. And so he devised a way to stagger the voice in its special trance cadence in its general semantic penetrative clarity, and to have native speakers of a language begin to talk to you directly through a trancing of what would get in the way, through a penetration to what is never in the way. And he found that you could learn a language in about 3 months. You could learn about 4 languages a year. And if you kept at it, you could learn dozens of languages. And I was the first person to make sure that this got a trial. And we sold them on Hollywood Boulevard. And eventually, after he passed away in 2000, he was 88, that language program now is the Rosetta Stone language program. Yeah. You learn the language because you have an innate disposition to be able to express orally through language images that roll on feelings. And the feelings are toned so that feeling tones and image sets and language capacity are braided together in such a way that literally the really big magic is an abracadabra. It is a way to pronounce and to enunciate, to express, to deliver, to resonate, so that the cadence and the vocabulary, the acrobatic syntax, the ability to move almost like a butterfly flying without having to have little angular adjustments, so that the freedom of this recalibrates the brain. Different languages have different centers in the brain. Japanese is considerably farther back than English. So that neurologically, if one begins to have the facility of many languages, your neural nimbleness becomes increased. And you learn to be able to express yourself in such a way that you could mix the languages together and express something that is ratiable, not in terms of language, but in terms of the human capacity to express. This becomes a prismatic mind. And a prismatic mind, once it's awakened, cannot be hypnotized. It does not trance out. And is able to discern instantly whether you are being lied to or not. And it is this yoga of penetrating attentiveness that gives us the next refinement of mankind. And I have called this Homo sapiens stellaris, star wisdom man. That our capacity, our ability, has been being prepared for more than 2,000 years. And one of the first indications of a science fiction vision occurs in a book called Pistis Sophia, the Faith Wisdom book. It's Greek. Pistis, Faith, Sophia, Wisdom. This book was lost to the world, except a copy surfaced in the 1700s by a traveler named Bruce, who was in Ethiopia, a very wild place in the 1700s, and he found a copy of it. And this copy was eventually purchased by a physician, wealthy London physician named Askew, and the Askew Codex languished for several generations until somebody began to read it and translate it, and it shows a remarkable science fiction capacity that was there, that was introduced by Jesus. In the chapter sequence, 84 through about 87, it reads in translation somewhat like this. "And as a result of their exceeding great glory, you will reckon this world before you as darkness of darknesses," because of how radiant reality is. "And you will look forth upon the whole world of mankind, and it will become the size of a speck of dust before you as a result of the great distance by which it is exceedingly distant from it, and as a result of the size by which it greatly exceeds it." This is repeated six times. That glorious world that makes this world a speck of dust, there is an even greater radiance that makes that world a speck of dust. And when you get to the sixth time, you realize that you have time jumped billions of light years. That you are able to look upon the layered, staggered, six-stage approach to a seventh stage, which has no stage. It is, in fact, a release from stages. That light is the light of lights. Not the light of stars, not photonic light, but the enlightenment that makes light able to be in the first place. The science fiction vision that we've been looking at this morning is a part of the whole movement that accentuated itself starting around 1700. It started just a little bit before it. In 1687, Sir Isaac Newton published his great Principia Mathematica, which took the foundation of mathematics and took away its limitations. So that what occurred then was one of the great books on it, on its effect, was called The Breaking of the Circle by Marjorie Hope Nicholson. It was the impact of having a precise mind that had no limitations. It had no perimeter. It was not defined by phenomenology. It was not definable. It was refinable. And that its refining was able itself to be refined so that you began to have something further than the essentials. You began to have a quintessential, which is an alchemical transform of the essentials, but that was able to be prismatically projected into a spectrum of possibilities, and that was like a quintessential fifth dimension of an infinite field of consciousness, prismed by a six-dimensional form of a differential spiritual person that was able to then make a kaleidoscopic all spectrums of a seventh dimension, which was a sacred history. And that sacred history, that seven-dimensional kaleidoscopic process, like a complex of flows, was able at last to disclose the true scalar of the cosmos. Exactly in between Van Vogt, who we've been focusing on, and Wells, when he first began, Wells, 1895, Van Vogt, 1939. Exactly in the middle of that was the development, right here in Los Angeles, of the Mount Wilson 100-inch Hooker telescope, which for the first time was able to enlarge our field of vision to be able to look now at galactic structures as if they were stars. And the amazed realization from a young researcher at the time named Edwin Hubble that there were more galaxies in the cosmos than there are stars in our galaxy. This was about the 1920s, early 1920s. And you began to have, exactly at that time, a realization that we had crossed some kind of a threshold. We had crossed over from a provincial astrology of stars that we could see, or constellations that we could name, could define, into a realm where there were, Isaac Asimov's great phrase, stars like dust. There were more stars in our galaxy than there are grains of dust on the Earth. And all of a sudden that was jumped, that there are more galaxies than there are stars, and that means that the scalar now is not only off the chart, it is chartless, cannot be charted. So that the acquaintance became that infinity is a reality, and that that reality is responsive to us when we are real, and that we are never isolate, but there are always tunable recalibrations that can make, the phrase is, whenever two or more are gathered together in my name, tuned, I will be there as well. And that too, tunability is extendable, expandable, refinable to any size of population of any kind of beings in the cosmos. One of the great themes that came out of this was in the early realization that something like this was stirring. And one of the classic books from that era is by W.Y. Evans Wentz. And Evans Wentz published, this is the first edition, The Fairy Faith in Celtic Countries. That the fairy realm was a realm where spiritual beings were real, and that our acquaintance with these spiritual beings was able to transcend a phenomenal limitation into a numinous, unlimited quality. The paper reprint of it shows a dolmen from Paleolithic times and a questing hermit with his staff. This kind of a staff is, 2,000 years ago, a shepherd's staff. When you watch your flocks by night, you have to make sure wolves don't get in, poachers. And a staff is very useful if you know how to use it. That's all you need. But it also helps to establish the pivot of the authority of the commands of the language so that one can choreograph what is happening and what is going to happen, what has happened that is important enough to be memorable. And in this way, there is such a thing as being a shepherd of men, of mankind. Evans Wentz, when he finished this, and the last section of it is entitled Rebirth and Resurrection, he was astounded that he had been investigating. Evans Wentz is from San Diego originally. His ranch was Mount Cuchama, that's to the east of San Diego, a sacred mountain. He was astounded that he began to get intimations, especially from a friend of his named W.B. Yeats, who was working with Sri Shrupit and a number of other swamis and yogis from India, of making his own translations of the Bhagavad Gita and of the Upanishads. And Evans Wentz began to realize that there is a strange affinity between the ancient Irish fairy realm and the Tibetan Vajrayana realm. And so he went, was one of the first of the individuals to be able to go to Tibet and to find Lama Kazidawa Samdap, who began to teach him the Tibetan language, but in a special way, because Tibetan as a language was never a folk language. It was made specifically to penetrate through the layers of presuppositions, of falsity, and speak directly in equanimous feeling-toned sets in a language that went directly to the core awakened quality, so that instead of gradually awakening from the outside in, one flashes from the inside out, and that's why it's called the Diamond Way, the Vajra Way. One realizes from inside out, so that the world becomes able to be transformed by the radiance of your participation in the phrase in translation, in clear light. That clear light operates instantly without the constraints of time and space, because it's in the cascading ecology of consciousness and the four dimensions of consciousness and the four dimensions of space-time are able to come together and make a set of eight, which reveals not their unity, but their complementarity. That complementarity is a nine-dimensional spectrum that, like all dynamics, all processes, is fertile to make a form. And the form that is made is a 10-dimensional hyperspace. That 10-dimensional hyperspace is both phenomenal and numinous at the same time, in complementarities. That 10-dimensional hyperspace makes it possible not only to travel any spatial distance, but any dimensional calibration, so that one can go forwards and backwards in time, as well as go anywhere in the cosmos in its expanse, even outside of the existing cosmos. The very last phrase, the very last paragraphs of the Voyage of the Space Beagle that we, by A.E. Van Vogt, reads this way. The problems which nexialism confronts are whole problems. Man has divided life and matter into separate compartments of knowledge and being. And even though he sometimes uses words which indicate his awareness of the wholeness of nature, he continues to behave as if the one changing universe has many separately functioning parts. The techniques we will discuss tonight, and then there's an ellipsis. He paused. He had been looking out over his audience, and his gaze had suddenly fastened on a familiar figure well to the rear of the room. After a moment's hesitation, Grossvenor went on. We'll show how this disparity between reality and man's behavior can be overcome. He went on to describe the techniques, and in the back of the room, his arch rival, Gregory Kent, took his first notes on the science of nexialism and carrying its little bit of human civilization. The expeditionary ship Space Beagle sped at an ever-increasing velocity through a night that had no end and no beginning. More next week.